Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is truth really stranger than fiction? Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, best known for his iconic detective character Sherlock Holmes, maintained that life is infinitely stranger than anything which the mind of man could invent. And that is good news for anybody reading David Grand's new collection of nonfiction stories, mined from his work as a New Yorker staff writer and contributor to The New Republic, The Atlantic, and The New York Times Magazine. The new book is called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. David, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back on the show.
This collection really is 12 amazing stories.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I have to know how many bizarre leads you have to chase down in order to find that one that turns out to be really worth it.
You know, that's a great question, because the truth is I chase down many leads. And for me, the most important part is finding the right story and the right idea. And I always believe if I find that, the rest will take care of itself. So I look into a lot of stories that end up on the cutting room floor because they either don't pan out or they're not as interesting. And so the 12 that are in this collection were really what I considered the truly kind of compelling, gripping, and most unusual in many ways.
And so many of them have these sort of O. Henry-type twists at the end. Did you always know that that was going to happen when you started out, or did you discover some of them by surprise?
Discovered them by surprise, mm-hmm. usually. I mean, sometimes you have some intuition when you start to look into a story, which keeps you going. But I would say that in many of the cases, the place I end up in these stories is very different than the place I imagine I would end up. And hopefully I try to take the reader on a journey. In many ways, that journey with those twists are very similar to the journey that I took as well.
So we won't spoil all of them, but I do want to talk about a few.
Okay.
I want to start with the first story in the book. Your subject is this Sherlock Holmes expert, Richard Lancelin Green, whose
right.
obsession was about finding these long missing papers of Arthur Conan Doyle's.
That's right.
And it seems like fans of Conan Doyle are more likely than the average person to be obsessives.
Yes, yes. I mean, this is just to your question, too. This was a story I had read, I think it was like two sentences, just in a news brief, that this great Sherlock Holmes scholar, the greatest Sherlock Holmes scholar, had been found dead in mysterious circumstances. And that was all the story said. And then I began to look into it, and he had been looking for this archive of papers, as you mentioned, trying to write the definitive biography of Conan Doyle. And as I quickly discovered, he was deeply obsessed with Conan Doyle and with Sherlock Holmes, with this quest to write a definitive biography, to basically unravel the mystery of Sherlock Holmes' creator. And then, of course, when he was found dead in mysterious circumstances, I discovered there were all these amateur sleuths who took up this case, which they saw as far greater than anything that Conan Doyle had ever created in the canon, and they became very obsessed with trying to solve this case. But as you said, Sherlock Holmes is a character that has historically drawn out people who are deeply fascinated with him. As T.S. Eliot once said, that people, when they speak of Holmes, fall into this predilection of thinking he is a real person.
Yeah, and there are Holmes fans who get angry if you talk about Conan Doyle.
Yeah, who knew? Like, these are these things I never know when I begin these stories. And usually I know very little about the subjects when I begin them. So as I discovered in this story, and who knew, that there were two different groups, the fans of Sherlock Holmes kind of divide into two clubs. And there are the Sherlockians, who are consumed with Sherlock Holmes and are so argue that he's a real character and therefore never want to mention Conan Doyle by name. And then there are the Conan Doyle devotees who, of course, see Conan Doyle as the great creator of Sherlock Holmes. And these groups do not always speak very well of each other, although Richard Lancelin Green, the main character, the protagonist of this story, who was found dead, was actually one of the few who did go back and forth between both groups.
So Green had done a really definitive bibliography of the work that was known to exist that Conan Doyle had put out, but he couldn't write what he felt to be the definitive biography until he had access to all these papers that had been long hidden.
That's right. He was on this very elusive quest. He really felt like to write a biography where he knew everything about Conan Doyle, he would need these missing papers. And these were these papers that had acquired great lore within these circles. Conan Doyle was said to have had all these letters and various diary entries. And this archive although there were references to it within the family, it then disappeared for decades, and nobody knew what happened to it. And Richard Lansing Green had spent many years trying to track down these papers so he could complete his biography. And this archive was said to be worth several million dollars, probably, you know, more than $4 million because of its value. And he eventually believed he had solved the case. He had tracked down a descendant of Doyle, his daughter, and he told friends that he had seen parts of the archive and that she had said she was going to finally give it when she died to the British Library so that scholars like Green could finally have access to these papers.
I suppose it's fitting for this story that the first time the papers turned up missing, the alleged thief was Conan Doyle's own son.
Yes, yes. Conan Doyle had three children, and the two sons, from what I gathered during my research, were not the two most reputable. And there were allegations that one of the sons may have originally stolen them. And there was even allegations of a descendant of a Russian princess who tried to get her hands on them. And so the heirs were apparently always fighting over these papers, which is why they had kind of disappeared from public sight.
And they were said by some to be cursed.
That's right, because of that. But, you know, various people who had apparently gotten their hands on them had suddenly perished and died themselves. And so it kind of contributed to the lore that these papers took on.
So Conan Doyle himself was really a fascinating character, particularly later in life. For one thing, he started getting really interested after having created the world's most logical character. He was obsessed with the paranormal.
That's right. He became very interested in spiritualism. His son had died during World War I, and he had actually been interested in spiritualism before that, as were many Victorians. But then after his son died, it really increased, and he really wanted to be able to communicate with his son, and many people believe that Conan Doyle had gone essentially mad by the end of his life with these communications. And one of the things that this story is really about, as are many of the stories in this collection, is we all desperately want to be like Sherlock Holmes. Mm-hmm. We all want to use these Sherlockian abilities, these powers of observation, these powers of deduction to make sense of our lives. And yet we are all very fallible, and none of us are like Sherlock Holmes. And sometimes the line between this seduction of reason, this desire to be able to explain anything, can lead to an element of madness. And you saw that in Conan Doyle's life, and you saw it in many of the characters' lives in the story.
Sir Conan Doyle went so far as to kill off Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
He had soured on the experience. He wanted his other writing to be highlighted, and nobody paid any attention to another sentence that he wrote that was not a Holmes story.
Yeah, he felt very haunted. He wrote these historical novels that he always thought were better than his detective fiction, and he was tired of everyone, you know, that Sherlock Holmes was essentially more famous and more highly regarded than him. And he finally killed off Holmes. He wrote in his diary when he did it, you know, killed off Holmes today. And he was delighted. And then, of course, there was a huge uproar in the public, and people literally wore black armbands. People denounced him. And he was eventually forced to kind of retreat and bring back Sherlock Holmes and continue writing them as if Sherlock Holmes had actually never perished.
He resurrected his own character.
He resurrected his own character who he had so triumphantly killed off.
So let's talk about Green again. We'll move forward in time. At what point did he start to tell his associates and his friends and his family that he felt like his life was in danger?
Yeah. It was during the investigation while tracking down clues about this archive, he began to believe. He suddenly read in the newspaper that parts of this archive were not going, Conan Doyle's daughter had died, but the archive was not going to the British Library as he believed it was supposed to, and he actually had a copy of the daughter's will that seemed to suggest that was where it was supposed to go. Instead, it was being auctioned off at Christie's, and he believed that it had actually been stolen. And while he began to make these allegations and say who he thought may have done it, he began to say there were threats on his life, that there was a mysterious American who was trying to destroy him, and many of his friends became very worried for him. He said he was being followed, and it was very shortly after that when his sister finally went to his house when he didn't respond to any communiques and found him garroted in his apartment on his bed.
Hmm. And on the same day that he was killed, there was an American voice on his answering machine.
That's right. And so after he died, first of all, it's very hard to self-garret. It's a very, very difficult thing. And during the inquest, they were not able to determine whether it was murder or suicide. It was left open. And there were various clues, including some of his friends who were these amateur sleuths as well, Sherlockians and Conan Doyle experts, one of them, they had called him just before he died, and they had gotten not his message on the machine, but this American voice. And this fit into their notion that he had said he was being pursued by some American. And so this was one of the clues that led some of them to believe that perhaps he had been killed and that he really was being pursued.
You found your way to the American.
I did. It turned out that the American, who asked me not to use his name, worked very high up at the Pentagon at the time and was a devoted Sherlockian. And he said he didn't want me to use his name because he didn't want, you know, people at the Pentagon to, know about his obsession with a literary character. And I met with him, and in speaking with him, I began to realize that this person who was supposedly Richard Lancelin Greene's nemesis really wasn't in many ways. Well, they had a rivalry, and they had a falling out, and partly over their friendship with Conan Doyle's daughter. He helped explain to me a bit about the history of the papers, and I slowly began to realize, you know, going back to your question about do you expect what you will find in these stories, and I had no idea what I would expect, and I began to gather clues from him and then others I spoke that Richard Lancelin Greene had most likely not been murdered, and in fact, the clues pointed to an even more fantastical possibility.
Tell me what was found around Greene's body.
Well, he had a shoelace around him. He had a bottle of whiskey or wine, which was one of these clues because Richard Lancelin Greene only drank wine, and people wouldn't thought he would have mixed drinks, which was another clue partly used. The other thing that was surrounded by him that was so amazing is Richard Lancelin Greene had become utterly and completely obsessed with Sherlock Holmes and Doyle, and his house was literally filled with every piece of paraphernalia you could imagine. Every book, every scrap of paper Conan Doyle had written, movie posters of Sherlock Holmes, so that everywhere he looked, he was surrounded by this man he had been stalking and this literary creation he had been stalking for decades.
One of the horrible ironies in this is that after his death, it was revealed that, in fact, the papers that he sought did find their way to the British Museum.
That's right. What turned out that there were two sets of papers, and just before she died, Doyle's daughter had split some of the papers and given them to some other heirs. Those were the papers that were actually being auctioned off. Her papers were, in fact, donated to the library, and then many of the ones that were actually auctioned off were then purchased by the British Library. And so as one of Richard Lancelin Greene's closest friends said at the end, the great tragedy was Richard could have done this book anyways. And one of the things you realize in these stories, and one of the things that I find interesting about these stories is that they are not like fiction. They are not fairy tales. And Sherlock Holmes stories really are fairy tales. That's part of their appeal. Here is a Superman of reason who always ties everything up neatly, and the world and the chaos of the world always gets ordered again. And one of the things I realized in the course of this research is that this one of the things you miss in these stories is that often the greatest mysteries are often tragedies.
David Gran is with us. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, whose new collection of nonfiction stories is called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. After the break, we will talk about the Texas case of Cameron Todd Willingham. But first, you can join us now on the line if you'd like to call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from summer youth programs at SMU in Plano, where kids can create, design, and think their way to a memorable summer. Details online at smu.edu/summerfun.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New Yorker staff writer David Gran. His new collection of nonfiction stories is called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I want to move on now, David, and talk about this case that a lot of Texans, in fact, followed, that of Cameron Todd Willingham.
Yeah.
Sentenced
yes.
to death for a particularly grisly crime.
Yes. I would say of all the stories in the collection, this was the most unsettling and disturbing. And as probably most of the listeners know, it's a story about Cameron Todd Willingham, who was convicted of setting a fire that killed his three children just before Christmas in 1991. And arson investigators had come into the house, found what they believed were more than 20 indicators of arson, including something called crazed glass, which is like a spiderweb pattern in the glass, which they said was caused from rapid heating when you pour a liquid accelerant on the floor, and also low burning and these kind of irregular-shaped char patterns where they said somebody had poured a liquid accelerant. Based largely on this evidence, as well as a jailhouse informant, Willingham was convicted. It took the jury barely an hour to convict him. He was sentenced to die, and he was finally executed in 2004.
You know, an interesting link to the story that we had before, when you talk about people's perceptions being shaped by what they think they're going to find, you write about witnesses' accounts of Willingham's reactions in the immediate aftermath of the fire, and then how those witnesses sort of changed their reflections on the events after they realized that he'd been arrested and charged with the crime.
Yeah, this is something, and I had not known about this before I did this story, but when I was actually looking at many of the eyewitness testimony, it was very evident and striking that people who were initially interviewed by authorities immediately after the fire had described Willingham as hysterical for the most part, described the fire, that it was impossible to kind of get in to get to the kids. They were kind of neutral and generally portrayed Willingham as very upset. In one case, he gave someone a black eye. Several people said they had to hold Willingham back. Then, once the arson investigators had come in and concluded that there were these indicators of arson, the eyewitness testimony began to change, and it began to grow more damning. Suddenly, Willingham was seen as either too hysterical, in other words, that it was somehow a show. Suddenly, people said that he was hysterical only after the authorities arrived, as if he were putting on a show for them. He hadn't been originally hysterical. And so you began to see these contradictions. And this is actually something that's very common and problematic in investigations. And it's what psychologists have often seen. It's called contextual bias. And there's a very famous experiment done with this where they showed witnesses a video of two cars crashing. And they asked the people who, after they saw the video, how fast were the cars going when they made contact? And that was the verb they used, make contact. And they gave an estimate, I'm just going to say, about 50 miles per hour. I don't remember exactly what it was. Then they asked them the same question, but they just changed one word. They changed the verb. They said, how fast were they going when the car smashed together? And suddenly everybody's estimate went way up. And they also asked the people, depending on the verb, did you see the windows shatter? And when they were asked if when the cars made contact, did the windows shatter, most people said no. And did they say, and in fact, the windows had not shattered. But when they asked them, did the windows shatter when the cars smashed together, people said, yes, they had shattered. So they created a false memory just based on that change. So that's what's referred to as contextual bias. And essentially in this case, what you saw is, in this case, once those arson investigators came to this conclusion and this determination, everything in the investigation begins to change and get colored.
And so it's not a matter of people telling lies. It's literally they remember to the best of their ability, but their memories have
That's
been
right.
colored.
Memories are not fixed. Every time we remember something, we remember it slightly different, and we're very influenced by contextual bias. There's many cases of this. In the course of my research, there was I read about a rape victim who always said she couldn't identify her attacker, and then at one point, a suspect had been there had been some lab evidence that connected him, and suddenly she identified him. She broke down crying. She said, that's him on the stand. And then later it was revealed that the lab test evidence was actually corrupted and wrong. It was actually someone else who had done the crime. And so she had become extremely upset just based on this contextual information and reached this conclusion. It's not done out of malevolence in most cases. Just as you say, it's a very innocuous, innocent thing. Generally, what it comes from people actually wanting to help.
Mm-hmm. So interestingly, at least initially, Willingham's wife, who had been the victim, admittedly, of spousal abuse at his hand, defended him and did not believe that he had anything to do with the death of their daughters.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, Willingham was a tough character. He was not somebody you would want to necessarily have over for dinner. He was a high school dropout. He drank. He sniffed glue as a kid. He did not have any arrests for any kind of violent crimes. He had some kind of petty thefts of very small things, like hood caps or tires or something. But he abused his wife. There's plenty of eyewitness testimony of that he used to hit his wife. But she was convinced he could not have done this and stood by him and believed that he would never have hurt the children. And she always testified under oath and during interrogations that while he hit her, he never touched the kids or ever laid a hand on them.
What did you learn in your investigation about how arsons are probed in the state of Texas?
Well, the problem is in the state of Texas and beyond. What I discovered is, you know, my notion when I began this story was probably like the notion that most people have, which is that these arson sleuths are kind of these Sherlockian characters. You know, we've seen them in movies or CSI. They come into a house and they kind of see all these kind of interesting patterns and they detect them, interpret them, and they're somewhat infallible and they reach these determinations. And what I discovered is that arson investigation for years in the United States and around the world was really just based on folklore, that it was based on bits of wisdom that were handed down by old-timers, that most arson investigators had little if no training. Maybe they took a month course and were certified. They mostly learned from old-timers, and they had all these ideas, like I described earlier in the conversation, this crazed glass. Well, the problem was that these notions had not been scientifically tested, and they began to be tested in the 1990s, and they still continue to be tested today. And as these tests were conducted, scientists suddenly discovered that most of these notions were either bogus, that they were simply old wives' tales, or they were deeply flawed in their interpretation. And so, for example, this crazed glass. Well, crazed glass has nothing to do with a liquid accelerant. It has to do with rapid cooling, thermal shock. When glass is very hot, firemen come to the scene, they shoot cold water in the glass, and that's what causes that pattern. Scientists have tried over and over again to try to get that pattern by doing rapid heating with liquid accelerant. It has nothing to do with it. And many of the indicators in the Willingham case, in fact, all the indicators, the leading arson scientists in the United States, many of them, not just one, often separately, have looked at this case and concluded that there was actually no scientific basis to conclude that this fire was intentionally set. One of the main indicators that the arson investigators had used was what was called low burning and these irregular patterns on the floor. Well, and I don't want to get too complicated, but when a house goes to what is called flashover, which is when thermal gases build up in a room, and you've seen this on TV or in fires, suddenly a room will explode in fire. Everything ignites. And that happened in the Willingham cases. All the witnesses described the windows blowing out in the children's room and the fire, this fireball exploding. And what happened is the house had gone to flashover. And when that happens, everything will ignite in a room, including the floor. And you get all these patterns that for so long were believed simply to be caused by arson.
And what was made of the fact that Willingham's wife testified that before she left that morning, she left the space heater on?
You know, it's interesting. I think it was really not paid that much attention to. And they concluded, they actually said when they came in, one of the arson investigators came in and said the space heater had been turned off. But interestingly enough, those investigators hadn't come to the house till I think it was like a week later, many days later. And there had been a lot of cleanup, was it on or wasn't on. But the wife had insisted it was on because she remembered because she had turned it down that morning. And this should have been an indicator or at least given them pause. But once they found all these other indicators that they believe are arson, that really was what was determining, and they believe they had overwhelming evidence, you know, as many as 20 indicators.
So as most people know, Willingham was ultimately convicted. How did his case attract the attention of innocence activists?
You know, interestingly enough, it was not one of these cases that garnered attention before or leading up to his execution. Willingham was somebody who pretty much went to the death chamber with very little attention and almost no outcry. A woman had begun to, a school teacher from Houston, a woman named Elizabeth Gilbert, had gotten to know Willingham when he was in prison, and she actually began to look into the case. Initially, she was sure he was guilty, and as she told me, she wasn't there to absolve him. But as she began to look into the case, she began to find these questions. The eyewitness testimony, there was a jailhouse informant in the case, and his testimony was very contradictory. And in fact, I eventually tracked down this jailhouse informant, and I've never met a person more jumpy in my life. He's extremely mentally unstable. As he admitted, he had many psychological disorders. And at one point, he asked me when the statute of limitations on perjury ran out. And when I told him that Willingham had been executed partly on his testimony, he became utterly silent. And then he looked at me and he said, "Nothing can save me now." And so this was used to also send Willingham to the chamber.
And he later recanted that testimony, right?
Well, yes, that's true. He did. He sent in a letter recanting, and then he recanted his recantation. But, you know, his testimony, if had anyone even looked at it on its face, didn't make sense. It was very contradictory. But that he was used. And so one of these things this case raises is questions, both in terms of getting reliable eyewitness testimony, but also the use of jailhouse informants, who are very unreliable. And so as this school teacher, Elizabeth Gilbert, began to look into the case, she began to find clues. Eventually, she had helped, along with Willingham's family, find a leading arson investigator, a guy named Gerald Hurst. And he looked at the case shortly before Willingham was executed. And when he looked at the case, he was astonished, and he realized that all these indicators that were used to convict Willingham of setting the fire were based on junk science. And he wrote up a report urgently. He only had a few days before Willingham's execution. He sent the report to the governor. He sent it to the clemency board. But the execution went ahead nonetheless.
What kind of legal representation had he had?
Well, you know, you asked me about something when you begin these stories. What do you think when you begin? And when I looked into this case, the first thing I did was I called Willingham's lawyer, one of his defense attorneys. And the first thing the defense attorney told me is, "Oh, Willingham did it. There's no question. There were all these poor patterns. You can't dispute those. The man did it, I'm telling you." And I thought after that, well, Willingham had to have done it. His own defense attorney thinks so.
Mm-hmm.
But then I began to look more closely at the case and realized there were serious questions. And Willingham wrote in many of his letters and his diaries, which I were able to obtain, how hard it was to have lawyers who refused to believe he was innocent. And in fact, before the case went to trial, the prosecutor came to Willingham and his defense attorneys with a deal for life. And Willingham said, "I ain't going to plead guilty." If they said if he pled guilty, they wouldn't execute him. He wouldn't face the death sentence. He would just face a life sentence. And he said, "I ain't going to plead guilty to doing something, especially killing my own children, that I didn't do." And this evidence, rather than giving people pause, was taken as further evidence that he was simply a sociopath who had no sense of remorse or repentance.
As you ended your writing on this, did you feel like you could come to a clear conclusion about what happened?
Many people have asked me this, and I always try to be careful the way I respond, because this isn't a DNA case.
Mm-hmm.
With a DNA case, there's never been a case there's never been a clear, irrefutable case in the modern judicial system of someone being executed who was innocent. And by the time I finished investigating this case, I personally had come to believe that Willingham, based on the evidence, was innocent. What you could say, and what I think I showed demonstrably in my story, is that all the evidence used to convict Willingham was utterly flawed, and that even the prosecutor in the case has said, given what we know now, that he would not have probably been able to even secure a conviction against Willingham. So this was a wrongful execution, and I do believe, you know, in our justice system, if the evidence can't convict you, you know, you are by definition, you're legally innocent. So But I do believe that no matter what people believe, you know, what this case highlights and what is so important, the thing I always try to emphasize, whatever you think about the death penalty or don't think about the death, you know, whether for or against it, what this case highlights is systematic flaws in the system that need to be addressed. There needs to be reliable rigor on scientific testimony. There has to be better rigor in terms of evaluating eyewitness testimony. Jailhouse informants have to be handled carefully. And the clemency system in Texas utterly failed in this case to even take note of this report or to evaluate it. And it should have given them and the governor pause, and it did not.
As you know, this has become kind of a flashpoint in the state for people who are arguing one way or another about the death penalty. I'm curious as to whether after the story first published in the magazine, whether you were sort of flooded with people who wanted you to look into what they thought was a wrongful conviction or execution.
Yes, I get a lot of letters and a lot of cases, and it's, to be honest, it's just me, and it's pretty hard. And I'm a journalist and kind of a generalist by nature, and I kind of found the story, but I have been inundated. And I guess the one thing that has unsettled me a little bit about the story was is that it, because it's become such a flashpoint over the death penalty, there are certain things about this case that really shouldn't be controversial and need to be taken into account and need to be fixed. And I think those things transcend even the question of whether you're for or against the death penalty.
David Gran is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and we're talking about his new collection of nonfiction stories. It's called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Up next, we will talk about the story of a French adult who took the place of a missing Texas teenager.
Funding for Think comes from summer youth programs at SMU in Plano, where kids can create, design, and think their way to a memorable summer. Details online at smu.edu/summerfun.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. New Yorker staff writer David Gran is my guest. He has a new book out of nonfiction stories called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. The last story I want to talk about in the program, David, is one that we've discussed before on this program a couple of years ago when it was first published. But The Chameleon is such a remarkable story and so well told that I can't get enough of it. Let's talk about Frederick Bourdin. He managed to pass himself off as the missing teenage son of a San Antonio mother. How did he begin his career, if you can call it that, as an imposter?
Yeah, in the introduction you said you quoted the saying from Sherlock Holmes that life is infinitely stranger than anything which the man of mind could invent. And if any story and character illustrates this point, it's this one. Frederick Bourdin was this kind of legendary, infamous, notorious French imposter. He grew up poor, rural France, from a broken family, had a pretty difficult childhood, didn't have a father. And very early on, he ran away, and he was kind of on the road, and he began to invent identities. He would create these kind of fictional worlds, creating these identities for himself so that he could be taken in orphanages and youth homes or foster parents. And he did this for many, many years. He started when he was, you know, just a young teenager, and he did this throughout his teens and then into his 20s. And then what was so remarkable was he continued to do this. And even when he was into his 30s, he continued to impersonate a child, even, you know, he was balding at the time. And the thing about it, and the thing that makes it so unusual, is there is no evidence, at least the prosecutors have ever been able to find, of a kind of normal motive that we would think of in cases of imposters or doing something like this. There's no evidence of pedophilia, which was something I wondered about. There's no evidence of theft or of stealing. As one prosecutor says, it really seems to be about emotional profit, about kind of recreating the psychological thing. And so he had always done this. And then, of course, we get to the moment in 1997 where the law was on to him. He was in Spain. And for the first time, he decided not to invent a character, but to steal the identity of a missing boy. And that boy was someone who had disappeared from Texas.
So, yeah, amazingly, he calls up, I guess, the Center for Missing and Exploited Children and says, I've got this kid here. Do you have anyone who matches this description?
Yeah, that's right. He pretended that he was an adult from this place where the shelter where he was staying at. He pretended he was that. He somehow managed to get access to an office and a fax machine. And he gave them this description, and they said, oh, they looked through their data bank, and eventually they found someone. They said, well, this could be Nicholas Barkley. And then Frederick Bourdin, playing the adult, says, wonderful, send me what information you have in the fax. They sent him the information. He said, oh, yes, that's him. We have him. And, of course, they were delighted and then alerted the authorities and the missing boy's family.
And I guess, once again, we have this contextual bias because there were, and we'll hear about these in a minute, there were a lot of things that should have raised red flags immediately. But people are not inclined to distrust, a person who claims to be a 14-year-old abused child.
Yeah, no, very few people do. And, you know, one of the things with cons is that we often think our notion of cons, again, are a little bit more like fairy tales, where the con is perfect, you know, it's something out of a David Mamet movie, everything is so clever. And in fact, most cons in real life are filled with glaring, obvious red flags, but these only become obvious after the fact. We are very inclined or disinclined to doubt the people we are speaking to.
So one of the big problems with claiming this identity was that the missing boy had blue eyes and Bourdin
yes.
has brown
eyes.
So
these would be called red flags.
Yeah, or brown flags.
Yes. Yes, he had different color here. And one of the things was initially when Bourdin had gotten the facts, it was very hard to see and the image didn't come through. And all he really saw was the data points. He thought, okay, I can do this. But they then also expressed to him overnight, sent him an original copy of the printout of the boy's face and description. And when he got that, he took one look and he said, oh my gosh, the kid has different color hair, different color eyes, several tattoos, which Bourdin didn't have. And he thought to himself he was dead. And he began to, first he had the tattoos placed on his body, then he dyed his hair a lighter color. And then he had the question of his eyes, which he obviously couldn't change. And he always had these maxims he used as an imposter. And one of his maxims was, keep it simple. In other words, when you lie, don't come up with something so elaborate, you're more likely to get tripped up. But in this case, he came up with a very elaborate lie that he had been abducted, and they had done experiments on him, and they changed his eye color. And then the amazing thing is, the missing boy's sister came to get him and brought him back to Texas, where the family greeted him at the airport, and they all believed or said they believed this was Nicholas Barkley. This was the missing boy. He had only disappeared about 3 years earlier, but they said they believed this was him.
Now, it's one thing for them to believe him at that initial hug, and they're so happy at the idea that he's back. It's another thing for him to go back and sort of inhabit another person's life. And one of the things he did was that one family member would remember a story, and then he would turn right around and go to another room and repeat that same story to another family member until he built up sort of a chain of things.
That's right. He began to, when he got there, he got pictures. He was given Nicholas's items, some letters, some articles of his clothing, and he began to kind of basically try to mine every piece of information. You got to understand he began with almost no information about this child other than just the physical facts, and he had to basically study this real character rather than simply invent a character, and he would do this just what you said. He would ask somebody, get a little tip, then repeat the tip casually in conversation. He would look at letters. He would look at home videos that were made in the family He would go rifling through drawers trying to find clues to try to create a portrait of this person. But along the way, one of the things that happened for Frederick was, for Bourdain was, he became very uncomfortable living in the skin of an actual person as opposed to an imaginary person. And he began to unravel during this process, although he lived with the family for more than a month.
Now, we should say there were red flags. Until this point, the family seems like these sort of duped victims, but there were red flags that should have gone up for Bourdain, that something was not right on their end.
Yes, there came a certain point where Bourdain began to wonder if the great con man, the professional liar, was the one who was being conned. He started to wonder whether he really could be that good an imposter. And he wondered, he had questions about Nicholas's half-brother, a man named Jason. Jason had not come to visit Bourdain at the airport and did not come to visit him for many weeks, even though here he was, you know, having disappeared. And then when he finally saw Jason, he thought Jason acted very strangely, and Jason gave him a cross, put it around his neck, and then left. And he became convinced that Jason actually knew what had happened to the real Nicholas and was potentially involved in a disappearance. And so he begins to become very suspicious and have doubts about what really happened to the missing boy and begins to try to look into it himself.
So how does all this start to come to light? I guess the TV show Hard Copy hired a private investigator to see what the story was.
Yeah, there's a private detective, a man named Charlie Parker, a PI, who was hired by Hard Copy to, at that point, simply to do a story about the recovery of this missing child. And so it was just a straight story based on, wow, Nicholas Barclay's been found. He's telling this crazy story. And so Charlie Parker went to the house where Bourdain was staying. He was living in this trailer outside of San Antonio. And he's looking at Frederick Bourdain when he's being interviewed, and he's looking at a picture of the actual Nicholas Barclay. He's going back and forth, and he's looking at the accents. He's looking at the eyes. He's looking at the hair. And then especially he hones in on the ears, on the kids, on Bourdain's ears. He had once read that each person's ears are distinct, almost like fingerprints. And he told the cameraman, focus on Bourdain's ears. And then he slipped in his pocket the photograph of Nicholas Barclay, took him back to his shop, blew them up, put them side by side, and became convinced that Bourdain was lying, that this was not Nicholas Barclay. He didn't know who it was. This was before 9/11, but he began to fear that a terrorist was living in the United States.
So he confronts Bourdain.
He confronts Bourdain. He begins to follow Bourdain. Bourdain says, no, you're wrong. I'm so-and-so. And the family continues to believe him and defend him. And Parker is kind of left not sure what to do, but is so worried he begins to tail Bourdain around Texas.
Now, talk about what ultimately you have met Bourdain on a number of occasions. What does his voice sound like when he's just being himself?
Well, he's very charming, and he's a very likable individual. I spent a lot of time with him. He speaks many languages. He's clearly very smart. He does speak English, though, with a pretty heavy accent. Which was another sign.
Not a Texas accent.
Not a Texas accent. Even in his best English, which he does English very well, he never has a Texas accent. And, of course, he had a story for this. He said he had been held in captivity, and so he was never able to use the language, and that's why. Now, Bourdain, who also contacted an agent from the FBI down there, was an FBI agent down there, a woman named Nancy Fisher, also begins to look into the case. And one thing they check with experts there, they said, well, if you're a native speaker and you're held in captivity and you can't speak, once you came back, would you resume your accent and regain your voice? And they said yes. And so that was another red flag.
So what are you left with in terms of your vision of human nature, having done all these stories? And there are several other very odd ones in there. I mean, do you have sort of has this work sort of skewed the way you think about people?
Well, you know, it's funny. Yes, in the sense when I finish these stories, I'm often surprised by that human nature can be a very dark, dark thing in many of these cases. I begin these stories, though, always, and I think I always maintain this with a certain naivete and a certain innocence when I begin them, and then, of course, I sometimes discover things. I would also say, though, that even within these stories and even within some of the more disturbing stories, there are people who also I truly admire, and I find their their humanity, very impressive. I mean, the woman who investigated Cameron Todd Willingham's execution, this woman Elizabeth Taylor, you know, I found a very moving character, and she had a very tragic accident just before Willingham was executed. I was in fact paralyzed, and I keep in touch with her, and she's been struggling to walk, and she just spoke to her just actually a few weeks ago, and she told me she had taken, she's been able to walk with the help of a walker and made it almost a football field. And so people like that you can't help but admire. So I guess the thing about these stories is you see the whole spectrum of human nature. And I would say, I guess, nothing quite surprises me anymore.
You definitely seem to have a gift as well for getting people to talk to you that would not appear to have any motivation to speak with a journalist about what they've been through or what they've done.
You know, and I don't think I have any really great attributes as a reporter, except for maybe one, which is I tend to kind of disappear. And I spend a lot of time with these people. And I think after a while, they kind of forget I'm around. And the thing I really want to do in these stories is to observe people as they are, to observe them in their milieu as much as possible, and to capture them as they are where they're not conscious. And so I think if that's the one thing is maybe just persistence and just kind of hanging around.
Is it strange then to sort of, you know, spend so much time with them and focus on their stories and then move on to the next thing?
Yeah, it is. It's a very strange quality. And, you know, many of the characters in these stories have elements of obsession in some ways. And I think that's a theme that links many of the protagonists in these stories. And I am by nature a bit of an obsessive, and I tend to disappear on these stories and become very consumed with them. Just like the characters were trying to use the art of detection to figure everything out, you know, like Richard Lansing Green wanting to write the definitive biography of Conan Doyle. I want to write the definitive story. I want to learn everything. And that's all consuming. And it is a little bit hard when it's suddenly over and you kind of say, what's next? And I think the only thing that kind of saves me is then I kind of can't imagine going back at it. And then eventually I get the scent of something and slowly that story will draw me in.
We just have a few seconds left, but I wonder if it was hard to curate from your body of work and pick these 12 stories, or if you knew instantly these were the ones.
I think it was pretty easy. I mean, there were a few that of stories that I really did like that I didn't quite fit the theme, and I didn't want to do a book that was simply a compilation of work. I really wanted these stories to somehow echo each other, even though their subjects are very, very different.
Well, we will look forward to the next collection then that gets those missing stories in. David Grand's new collection of nonfiction stories is called The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, Tales of Murder, Madness, and Obsession. David, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much
for having me on the show. I had a great time.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.